Okay, I want to begin in a non-typical fashion by reading to you two pages of paper that I wrote. I trust that you'll be sufficiently, engaged. On the evening of January 28, 1919, Max Weber, who was a social theorist, took the podium at a bookstore in Munich to deliver a talk to a group of leftist-leaning students. That talk would become his classic work, Politics as a Vocation. Weber was reluctant to give the lecture, not only because it took place in the middle of what these authors call a political hothouse that marked the time between the German surrender in the First World War in November of 1918 and the Treaty of Versailles in June of 1919. So you've got a lot going on right in this January period, right? But also because, as he saw it, the left-leaning student audience was without, quote, any sense of what political maturity in the present or foreseeable situation might be, end quote. He took it as his task, then, to disillusion them because, as he told them, they would find neither easy answers nor favorable resolutions to the current crisis in which they found themselves. In the most famous section of Weber's talk, he contrasts an ethics of ultimate ends with an ethics of responsibility. To put it succinctly, responsibility defines the true vocation of the politician against alternatives driven by ideology or aspirations for moral purity. The ultimate end of ideology or moral purity makes politics impossible. Better then, to be realistic about the enormous interdependencies, uncertainties, circularities, and conflicting stakeholders that constitute any politics, and to shoulder the burden of these so-called wicked elements in pursuit of some overarching goal. In an ethics of responsibility, the ultimate end is transposed into an overarching political goal. But at any point, that overarching goal can transpose back to an ideology, an ultimate end. And this is roughly what Weber thought a demagogue represents. The politician who fronts as a responsible person in his blustering rhetoric about this or that overarching good of his particular political community, but who in fact has not a whit of the gravity that genuine politics both requires and engenders. The difference between an overarching political goal and an ultimate end is that the overarching political goal is always as defined by the adjective political as it is by the noun goal. The realities of politics frustrate the pursuit of goals, meaning that politics is the perpetual pursuit of an end we can never truly reach. If that sounds like a high modern account of tragedy, that's because it should. In quintessential Weberian fashion, the responsible politician is already at home in the world of disillusionment because he is a native of the world of disenchantment. The young people in the bookstore aren't ready to face the wicked problems of their day because they have yet to come to grips with the fact that politics is about the ongoing work of constructing proximate and penultimate solutions for wicked problems. And that's difficult enough, but it's only the first step towards the disillusionment of responsibility. The genuinely responsible person knows, in an even more difficult second step, to expect that these proximate solutions are themselves the materials with which the next wicked problems will be constituted. So it's a very uplifting passage, my writing. No matter what you do, no matter what solutions you come to, the solution itself will be the raw materials with which the next problem will be built.
So when did you write this paper?
2 years ago, 3 years ago. Beginning a class, so today's topic is on Anglican moral theology with reference to talk that Weber gave to left-leaning German students in the emerging interwar period is counterintuitive, I suppose. Weber was as he put it famously, religiously unmusical. That's how he put it. He did a lot of sociology, religion, this sort of stuff, but he didn't quite get it himself. And so to begin with, begin a talk on Anglican moral theology with Weber is a bit interesting, I suppose, or counterintuitive, as I said. But I think that there is something to Weber's account that has some deep resonance with at least my interpretation of the Anglican, let's call it charism, the gift that Anglicanism has or offers to the church and the world when it comes to moral theology. In a second counterintuitive step, I want to use a 20th century American Lutheran theologian to explain what I mean. So I came to SMU to study with a man named Robin Lovin several years ago when I arrived at SMU. And the reason is because he was, from everything I could tell, definitely one of the world's, maybe the leading expert in a figure from the 20th century named Reinhold Niebuhr. If you aren't familiar with Niebuhr, there's actually a really lovely documentary about his life that was put out a couple of years ago called An American Conscience by a filmmaker named Martin Doblmeyer, and I highly recommend it. It's a really, really good film, very compelling. And Niebuhr was really influential on a number of thinkers across sort of disciplines throughout the 20th century, so that George Kennan, who is the diplomat who crafted what's called the Long Telegram, that actually set up the policy of containment that defined the American approach in the Cold War, the United States Cold War mentality. Eventually, Kennan, by the way, became a vigorous opponent to, say, Vietnam, where he thought that the approach that he had outlined in the Long Telegram of containment, etc., was being used to very destructive ends. But Kennan was himself the author, the architect of the 20th century American foreign policy. And Kennan said Niebuhr was the father of all of us. Anybody who thought of themselves as what would be kind of a sort of a realist account of politics, Niebuhr was really influential on them. So I came to SMU to study with a guy who was a Niebuhr scholar, and I'm going to just use his account of Niebuhr's overarching vision. Niebuhr had what he called his ethics of Christian realism, or an account of what he called Christian realism. And according to Lovin, Christian realism is actually constituted by three overlapping or sort of different pieces of realism. The first is theological realism, so it actually makes claims about God that it takes to be real. Right? God isn't just some construct in our mind. The famous criticism from Feuerbach is that God created man in his image and man returned the favor. Right? So God is nothing but the projection of our desires, if you're Freudian, or the opiate of the masses, if you're Marxist or whatever. But in its most damning terms, God is just whatever we needed and we created it. Christian realism, by contrast, is theologically realist, which means that it says when we use the word God, even if we don't know fully what that the thing to which that word refers, we actually do think it's not something just in our minds, right? God is, in fact, real in this sense. And the claims that we make that are theological have genuine purchase in the world. This is another one is political realism, which is the kind of realism that you get in these 20th century political thinkers. Weber's account of disillusionment and leaving his, you know, left-leaning students frustrated is one version of it. People like Kennan, whom I've already mentioned, Hans Morgenthau, people who saw the war periods and then saw the emerging threat of the Soviet Union, thought in terms of political realism in the sense that you made your political choices with open eyes. You realize that the political choices that you made had genuine consequences, had genuine drawbacks, and you made them in the face of that. So that you paid attention to hard power, money and military might, right? That's how you made your choices. In the crassest version of political realism, morality plays no part at all. In fact, it's a red herring. So you ask, should we be doing this? Like, is it a part, like, are we violating international law? And in so doing, you actually are jettisoning the principles of moral realism. Niebuhr's genius is to hold together political realism with this already, like, theological realism that God is always bearing down on us, as it were, right? Like, God is judging us for the proximate and political decisions that we're making in these spaces, and this is generated by, or helps generate, his moral realism. So this would be the third one. So the genius is to be able to hold together a clear-eyed, tactician's practical political analysis in the field of, like, domestic relations and international relations with moral realism, that we will, in fact, be held accountable for the judgments, the political actions that we undertake. But that should not keep us from making genuinely required political decisions. Does that make sense? This threefold sort of vision of realisms: theological, political, and ethical realism. Let me see if I can shut this door. So what does any of this have to do with Anglican moral theology? In a recent book called The Book of Common Prayer, A Biography, Alan Jacobs writes this about Thomas Cranmer. He's writing about how Cranmer is beginning to craft the Book of Common Prayer by writing a litany. The very unpredictable king that he is working under and for in the relationship, right? And says that Henry VIII, he had been made head of the English Church and denied the Church at Rome any authority in England in 1534. And he had shown some reforming sympathies. But as time had gone by, his love of older ways and the old church language of Latin had returned. Cranmer therefore understood the challenge of composing an English liturgy capable of gaining Henry's wholehearted approval. This is what I want to read, this paragraph. We cannot guess with any degree of confidence how Cranmer calculated. He is one of the more inscrutable characters in English history, whose actions at times seem guileful, disingenuous, or temporizing, and at other times doggedly persistent and deeply principled. All we know is that in the end he chose to compose a litany, and that few other choices would have been so agreeable to the king. And he goes on to explain that the litany is pretty much a prayer for the king to maintain his power, right? So this is one of the ways that he gets the favor of the king in his reforming efforts. But that description of Cranmer, right, guileful, disingenuous, or temporizing, and at other times doggedly patient and deeply principled, it's a fairly nice description of the kind of character and world that a Christian realist would expect, right? Someone who can hold together the clear calculations that political realism requires, but who realizes that the best efforts, or that those efforts themselves, those political efforts, are under moral judgment, so a moral realism to it, all ordered to actually bringing God to the people, right? A theological vision, a real, genuine theological realism. I think that's a pretty accurate description of the charism that Anglicanism gives to the world. Or, as I've told other people, it takes a lot of gall. Well, here's the way I say it. Anglicanism has no golden era from which it emerged, right? So I work for the Methodists, and the Methodists are always saying, if we could just get back to, like, John Wesley, right? And the Calvinists, if we could just get back to Calvin. And the Pentecostals, if we could just get back to the Book of Acts. And nobody in Anglicanism says, if we could just get back to Henry VIII, that would be better, right? We got it. We would have it taken care of. There is no fall narrative in Anglicanism, like a golden age from which we have fallen. It's always been Cranmer and Cromwell and Henry VIII from the beginning. And it's a genuine act of faith to say, you know what? This is where we've come from, and we've just stuck together, lo, these many hundreds of years praying. That's the gift that Anglicanism offers to the world. It's genuinely realistic about human nature, right? Where we come from, what kind of creatures we are. It's genuinely, in the face of that, hopeful about the kinds of work that we can do in the world. And the reason that it's hopeful is because it offers those hopes to God in prayer. Like, that's the thing that holds the whole thing together. It's the Book of Common Prayer. How does this contribute to moral theology, to a genuine, like, the kind of moral deliberation that we've been engaged in this semester? Well, not directly, right? One way that you could say this is that Anglicanism is happily derivative. Now, we like to say it in more flowery terms, right? Like, we hold the via media or something. We take the best of both Roman Catholicism and Protestantism, and that just means we're derivative on both counts, right? We don't really have something that we've ginned up on our own. No amazing insights. Like, the amazing insight was, you know what? Henry's the leader of the church. That was it. That was the ball game. That did it. And then all of the reforming efforts, like to give people a Bible of their own in their own language, to give them a liturgy of their own in their own language, to give them a prayer book of their own in their own language, all of that flowed from it. It was deeply intertwined, but trying to tease out the causality and say, well, it was really the moral aspiration or the theological aspiration that drove the political, that wouldn't make any real sense given the deep intertwining of the political and the theological in that sort of context out of which Anglicanism emerges. So Anglicanism is happily derivative of what it is willing to take on. And this, I think, gives it a two-sided sort of coin feature to us. Gives us we have two sides to ourselves. One is to be very humble and say, well, look, this is actually how human nature works. This is, in fact, the church, right? God's great gift to the world, the church. Like, in our, like, flavor emerged out of Henry VIII, which is not exactly highly morally aspirational. So we're humble. But at the same time, then, and ironically, maybe, we can be confident. Because the thing that we think that we're offering to the world is not our works, not what we do on our own effort, but what we offer to God, which is, again, our prayers. What we're offering to the world is God, not ourselves. And so there's a genuine kind of holding together of humility and confidence. Or as one contemporary Anglican moral theology puts it, those who do not presume may be confident. Right? There's a difference between presumption, that our presumptions about what it is that we can do, our presumptions about ourselves, our presumptuousness actually works counter to the kind of confidence that we can operate in when what we're being confident in is God, which is a genuine humility. And this brings us back around to, I think, the thing that I said in our very first session, certainly early on, where I quoted another contemporary Anglican theologian who says that when we act, our knowledge of what it is that we're doing, when we act morally in the world, our knowledge is limited to just what's before our feet, the next step in front of us, right? And so any action at all, any moral action, has the quality of prayer to it. Because we act, and in acting, we release our action to God. The example I used, do you remember me saying this? Does this ring any bells at all? The example that I used was a novelist, right? You see novelists write in the foreword or the introduction of their work something like, now I release this out into the world, right? Until I published it, it was mine, I could continue to tweak it. I knew what I meant it, wanted it to do. I knew what the characters were supposed to do, et cetera, et cetera. Like it was mine. But as soon as I release it into the world, it ceases to be mine. It now belongs to other people because they do with it, they read it, they do with it what they like, right? So they read it in certain ways. And so what I have, the control I have over it, now no longer exists. And the same thing is true with our moral actions. The attempts that we make to solve genuine problems in our world, when we make those attempts, when we undertake those actions, we cease to be in control of them. The act goes and does something else. And so for this contemporary Anglican moral theologian, Oliver O'Donovan is his name, he says, our action then requires God to give it back to us as a mercy vouchsafed. God takes the action and does with it as God wills. And then, in God's mercy, returns it back to us. So all of our actions, all of our moral aspirations, all of the things that we do in the world to try and make the world a better place, if they're genuinely like influenced by this kind of Anglican charism, I want to suggest, have the shape of prayer. They have the shape of humility. We offer them to the world. We don't impose them on the world. The difference is not going to be visible because it really is a difficult world that we act in, like Cranmer's, right? And sometimes it will look like guileful and disingenuous acts, or they will look that way. And at other times, we will appear doggedly persistent and deeply principled, and sometimes both at the same time. This is why I began with Weber, because the kind of genuine, realistic, responsible posture that is required for us to act in a world like ours means that we have to be aware that even the best of our actions will sometimes be the raw materials out of which the next problem is built. And it takes genuine confidence in God to act anyway. And that, I think, is the feature that Anglicanism offers to us as we think about how it is that we act in the world. Okay, I think I'm done with that part. Any questions on that? Does it make sense? Thoughts?
Aren't there some choices on our part?
I want to say that all of these are choices on our part. They're just difficult. This is why I, each week we've done the sort of discussions, right, about these things. I've tried to push everyone to actually say, this is what we should do. And this is why it's so difficult to say that, because I think that we can see that when we take a stand in one arena, this is what I was trying to get at last week, it redounds to other arenas. Like, it has unintended consequences. Acting in the world is dangerous. It's dangerous for your soul and it's dangerous for the world. And as we interrogate real problems, we can see just how dangerous that is. It comes into focus in a certain way. And it makes it difficult for us to act. And this is why I think that all of these have, they're genuine decisions that we have to make. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. So there's some interpretation on everybody's part that may not be the same.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, so what I thought, I mean, we can continue, you can ask questions, push back, I mean, whatever. But we have about 20 minutes, and this is the last time that we are gathering for this. So what I want to do is open up the 20 minutes to instead of having a topic, like for a moral problem, You can sort of bring whatever, if there are any moral topics that remain genuine questions for you, right? So we can have just a conversation about pretty much anything that we haven't covered yet, or if you want to return to some of the other things that we've covered, politics, war, economics, family, immigration. Did I miss any? We can do that as well. So what I want to do is just open it up for conversation for the next 20 minutes.
You know, in general terms, I like the point that you made about the end of not having a golden age to return to. I think that's kind of important. Now, I'm thinking about the Catholics, they would probably say the early church, but as Anglicans, I don't even think that we would say that, because we believe time has changed. We believe we've evolved, I think, in response to the changing times, using our three-legged stool of scripture, tradition, and reason. So I think that's actually a strength of the Anglican tradition in terms of our ability to evolve in the Kingdom of society, and a relevant way for a certain group of Christians in England.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that's a good point, Mike.
Thanks. I think that one inherent temptation in this, though, is to think that every change is, in fact, an evolution. Right? And a more genuine, I think, approach to this would be to say, like, we should make these changes with fear and trembling. Right? Yeah, so even Cranmer, like I said, it's happily derivative, right? It's not a wholesale ginning up of a new thing. Anglicanism, I mean, it's intrinsically conservative in a British sort of way, right? It's Burkean. It's not revolutionary in like the French sort of version of it, right? And so part of the confidence in God that is paired with the genuine humility about our own ability to act, I think, should be to interrogate whatever sorts of like adaptations we think we are naturally follow, right? Do they in fact? Or to put it differently, evolution is slow. So do you have questions? I mean, we really do have about 20 minutes. I don't want to hold you. If you want to go drink coffee, I'm perfectly fine with that. But we have 20 minutes to cover the entire world of morality. So this is like the opportunity that we have at the sort of end point of what we've done together.
So with what you just said, what do we do from day to day? I mean, what's in practical terms, what's one to do?
That's a great question. I think praying the daily office is probably a good start. Right? I mean, there's no better way to have your actions take the shape of prayer than to learn to pray. This is actually one